Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome you to today's webinar regarding CMS's recently released regulations, and we're very fortunate to have such a high level of speakers, beginning with Mark Siegel from General Electric. We have Robert Antony from CMS. We have Dr. Lewis Sandy from United Health Group, and for comments, we have Dr. Sam Ho, also from United Health. Just as a reminder, some administrative stuff. Please mute your line. This call is being recorded. And also, when it comes time for the question and answer, please use the chat. It'll be easier with such a large amount of participants that we have on this call. I know that we've got a really heavy agenda, and so I'd like to give you just a very brief overview of eHealth initiatives. EHI has been in existence for almost 16 years, and we've been conducting research, education, and advocacy. And we now have a foundation. The missions of these two organizations are the same, to drive improvement in the quality, safety, and efficiency of healthcare through information technology. Our work is primarily centered around the EHI 2020 roadmap. This is a document that was the work, the collaboration of our members, focusing on interoperability, data access and use, and business and clinical motivators. And the work is to provide a solution and enable a coordinated efforts by both public and private sectors to transform care delivery through data exchange and health information IT. We have a very diverse membership, as you can see in this slide here, from providers, vendors. We have everyone, and it would be terrific if you would like to join us. You can see from our board of directors a very strategic and elite group of people. So we're very fortunate to have the membership that we do to provide input and support for the work that we're doing here at eHealth Initiative. So the next slide is just to show that we've got I went ahead of myself. This is the EHI 2020 roadmap. And through the 2020 roadmap, we have EHI programs. We work on policy. Each of these focus areas of the 2020 roadmap are programs with business and clinical motivators, data, not only looking at privacy and security, but also data analytics. And we also do interoperability. So on that note, I would like to turn this over to Mark Siegel, who's actually going to be facilitating the call. Mark?
Thank you very much, Claudia, and thanks to all of you for attending this very timely webinar today. I'm Mark Siegel. I'm Vice President of Government and Industry Affairs for GE Healthcare IT, and also a media task chair of the eHealth Initiative's Policy Steering Committee and current member of the eHealth Initiative's Leadership Council. We're going to have the privilege today of hearing from national experts on new federal government and private sector payment models about the changes that we can expect related to the recently released CMS proposed rule. It was released on April 27 to implement the so-called MACRA legislation. Now, this proposed rule has a very easily remembered name, Medicare Program, Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, MIPS, and Alternative Payment Model, APM, Incentive under the Physician Fee Schedule, and a Criteria for Physician-Focused Payment Models. So I hope everybody has that. And also note the new acronyms that we're going to all be dealing with, adding to our, I'm sure, already very long list of healthcare acronyms, MIPS and APMs. Now, the display version of the rule that I've been working with is over 900 pages, 962 to be precise. The final Federal Register version that's now available is only 426 pages, but the type is an awful lot smaller. So this is a big, big rule, and not just in size. It starts the formal CMS work to implement the kind of fundamental policy change that typically occurs once in a generation. And it also includes major policy adjustments of the kind that tend to come about once every 10 years. So the meaningful use program that we'll hear about, it's being transformed, is nearly 8 years old now. The current Medicare physician payment system is about 25 years old, and the sustainable growth rate that MACRA specifically replaces was nearly 20 years old. So the purpose of the webinar today is to help you understand the rules, to help you think about how you might approach commenting if you're so inclined, and probably more importantly, to help you start the organizational planning that will enable you to succeed in the new model. So during today's webinar, as Claudia said, we're going to be hearing from three policy experts. First up will be Rob Anthony from CMS, who's going to be focusing on the MIPS path under MACRA. After Rob concludes, and I think with some Q&A, we'll be hearing from Dr. Lewis Sandy from the United Health Group. Lou's going to be focusing on the alternative payment model path. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to my friend and colleague, Rob Anthony.
Thanks, Mark. Hello and good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rob Anthony. I'm the Deputy Director of the Quality Measurement and Value-Based Incentive Group. My group is overseeing a lot of the policy and operation around the merit-based incentive payment systems. Mark mentioned a number of acronyms that are being thrown at folks, and pretty soon I'm going to throw another one at you, QPP, the Quality Payment Program. That is what we are proposing to call the umbrella program that is MACRA that drives toward payment reform. I actually have a limited time. I'm going to warn everybody. I'm only able to be with you until 5 o'clock, and I have a hard stop. So I'm going to move very, very quickly through some slides and give you a very broad overview of what we are proposing for the merit-based incentive payment system. Can we go to the next slide? So this is just a standard disclaimer, and I want to stop before I get into anything. Occasionally, I may lose my place, and I may misspeak. It is important for everybody to understand that this is a proposed rule, and we are in a public comment period. Nothing here is finalized. At this point, nothing is required. These are all proposals that the Department of Health and Human Services and CMS have put forward, and we are asking for people's feedback on this. There are a variety of ways for people to give feedback about this. You can comment in writing. You could comment electronically. Just make sure, please, if there's something that you need further clarification about or something that you want to hear more about or you think there's not sufficient detail in that regulation, I would encourage you to comment. Next slide. So I'm going to go through just a few things. I may skip over a number of different slides just in the interest of time, but I want to talk about, you know, the quality payment program, MACRA, and the overall goals of HHS and the Secretary. What is broadly the quality payment program? I will very briefly cover how you submit comments on the proposed rule. I'm going to go into a lot more depth specifically about MIPS. And then next steps, I think I'll knock out right now and just say the next steps is that we have a 60-day comment period, and we are inviting people, and we are listening, and we encourage people to talk about what it is that they like and dislike about this particular reg. Next slide. So obviously, the quality payment program as a whole is part of a broader push toward value and quality. Mark had talked a little bit about some of the payment reforms that have and other initiative programs that have been tried in the past and recently. Quality payment program aligns very much with some of the public goals that people may have heard about. In January of last year, the Secretary announced some new goals for value-based payments and for alternative payment models within Medicare. You can see one of those goals was having 30% of overall payments on quality or value tied to alternative payment models by the end of this year, a goal which we are on track to meet currently, and half of payments being involved with alternate payment models by the end of 2018. And then the second goal, again, one which we are on track with, especially with quality payment program as we proposed it, is to have 85% of Medicare fee-for-service payments tied to quality or value in some way by the end of this year, 90% by the end of 2018. If you, next slide. Obviously, prior to MACRA, everything was very much a fee-for-service system where patients were, or clinicians were paid based on the volume of the services. There's definitely a provision within MACRA and within QPP to tie those directly to a number of different factors. We'll go through some what some of those are. It is important to keep in mind that MACRA was established as sort of a replacement for sustainable growth rate, which Mark mentioned. So we had a number of these that were supposed to affect the overall payment and help keep Medicare costs in control in general. As everybody knows, we all kicked the can down the road year after year to the point where we had gotten to in 15. If we had not put something into place, there would have had to be an automatic 21% cut in Medicare payments that were enacted as part of SGR. MACRA is the replacement for that. It sunsets SGR. Next slide. And really moves us to a more predictable payment method that really ties directly to value. I'm going to go over some of what MIPS in particular does with that, but obviously there's another section of this regulation around APMs that that we won't be going into today, but that you can get some more information about us through some other means. Next slide. Just going through, obviously, quality payment program is what we're calling that umbrella of MIPS and APMs. We used to have a fantastic slide when we were talking about what MACRA did, and I'm not sure what happened to it, but it was a diverging arrow that basically showed that clinicians coming into this program under MACRA, under a quality payment program, we'll choose one of two ways to participate in the program. One of them is the merit-based incentive payment system. The other is advanced alternative payment models. This does a couple of things that with programs that people may be familiar with. On the APM side, it obviously scales a number of payment models to a larger group of people over time. On the MIPS side, which I'm going to primarily talk about, it actually streamlines a number of existing reporting programs into a single method. I think that a lot of people are probably familiar with the physician quality reporting system, obviously meaningful use, the value-based modifier. All of those get pulled into MIPS, and another category gets added as part of that MACRA legislation. Next slide. So just this next slide very quickly talks about how, the 60-day comment period, regulations.gov is where I suggest people go to submit electronically. You obviously could go through regular mail if you wanted to do that. So next slide, and actually we're going to go to the one after that because now we're going to get into the heart of talking about MIPS. So MACRA as a statute required four components as part of this incentive-based payment system, four ways in which people would be evaluated that would roll up to a total composite score. And that's what those, that's what these icons represent, these four categories upon which people's total composite score and their evaluation would work. One is in quality, one is in resource use, one is in clinical practice improvement activities, and then one is in what we're calling advancing care information that aligns very closely with the previous meaningful use program. Obviously, quality measurement happened previously under the physician quality reporting system. A version of resource use happened previously under the value-based modifier, which looks at claims activities. EHR, meaningful use of an EHR, happened previously under the EHR incentive programs, but now we're really measuring those parts of EHR usage that are around care coordination under this advancing care information category. And then we have this new category that we have proposed some activities for clinical practice improvement activities. Next slide. And those you see are the existing programs that get aligned underneath this proposal for MIPS. So next slide. When you go through the reg, and you will see, as Mark said, that it is a large portion, and that is because this is a large program. It will affect a large number of physicians and clinicians, and it will align a number of existing programs. But when you go specifically through the MIPS part, you're going to see that we broke it into some major sections. One is about eligibility, who can participate and who can't participate and who may be participating in the future. We then go through and we talk specifically about each performance category, so specifically about the quality reporting category, specifically about resource use and so on. And then we talk about scoring, scoring in each of the categories and then how that scoring rolls up to the total composite score and how that aligns, obviously, with the later part of payment adjustments. We talk a little bit about data submission, how that's going to be done, the different ways in which one can submit. And then we talk about the performance period and the payment adjustments. So in other words, there's a period in which you perform activities, there is a time in which you will report, and then there will be a time in which the positive or negative payment adjustments will take place. All of those things are proposed right now. That's the basic outline that you'll see within the reg when you go and take a look at it. Next slide. So obviously, there are some different provisions within the statute, and this is what we are proposing based on those provisions about the different types of Medicare Part B eligible clinicians that are going to be affected by MIPS in years one and two. It's going to be physicians, so that's MDs. It will also be doctors of dental surgery and medical dentistry, PAs, nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, and certified registered nurse anesthetists. In future years, the secretary is able to broaden the eligible clinicians that can participate in MIPS, and some of what we have put on the table as a proposal are physical or occupational therapists, speech language pathologists, audiologists, nurse midwives, clinical social workers, and so on. So we're inviting comment about that, expanding that participation in future years. Next slide. We have three groups of clinicians that are not going to be subject to MIPS. Obviously, we've given a pass to people who are in their first year of Medicare Part B participation. You don't have any previous performance upon which to base any type of payment adjustment. So we basically give everybody a check in that first year. We have people who are already involved in certain of the most advanced alternate payment models. If you're involved in that, you also don't have to participate in MIPS at the same time. There are some eligible APMs that you could participate in concurrently with MIPS, and you could actually receive a bonus from both that eligible APM and from MIPS. But there are some of the most advanced APMs you would participate solely through that. And then finally, and most importantly, we are proposing that providers below a certain patient and volume threshold would not be subject to MIPS. And what we are specifically proposing is that Medicare billing charges of less than or equal to $10,000 in a year and a provider who provides care for 100 or fewer Medicare patients in 1 year. It's both of those things, both of those thresholds, not one or the other that we are proposing. And, of course, one of the things that we do note is that MIPS as a whole does not apply to hospitals or facilities and facility-based physicians. Next slide. So if you take a look at the one of the things that we lay out in MIPS is at least the beginning of a timeline that will represent how we anticipate MIPS working as a whole. You would have a performance period. That would be January through December of a particular year. In this case, you can see that it is the year 17. You would have the next year for reporting to CMS, for CMS to do data collection, for them to do analysis and scoring of the data as it has come in. There would be an opportunity to get a feedback report during that period for each physician or group. And then there's a provision under MACRO where you can request a targeted review, essentially like an informal review, based on that performance. Then in the following year, 2019, that MIPS adjustment would actually go into effect, whether it is a positive or a negative payment adjustment. Next slide. I think this has been fairly common knowledge, but just so people know, we tier upwards according to the law about how much the MIPS can actually affect payment. We start in 2019 with a positive or negative 4%, and it tiers up to a maximum of 9%. Next slide. We do think that most clinicians will be subject to MIPS in the beginning. There will be some that are in advanced APMs. Many won't be in APMs at all. Many will be in non-advanced APMs. They might be in an advanced APM, but they may not be what is called a qualifying participant. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all of that. You can probably find more of that information in some of our APM webinars, but I will just say that we do anticipate that the vast majority of clinicians will be subject to MIPS and will participate through that. Next slide. One of the things that we are proposing here is that eligible clinicians can participate in MIPS in a variety of ways. You can participate as an individual. You can participate as a group. The group in this case would be defined by the taxpayer identification number, your TIN number. We would assess group practice across all four of those MIPS performance categories. There is a provision within the MACRA statute asking about establishment of virtual groups. We are not proposing that for year one, although we are soliciting comments on a couple of questions regarding virtual groups. But at least in the beginning, what we are proposing here is being able to participate both as an individual or as a group. Next slide. I'm going to go very quickly through some of the performance categories and try and highlight some of what the interesting things that we have proposed and are seeking comment on in each of those. If you go to the next slide, here we are, and you see those categories, again, the four categories. Each of those categories will come up with a score. These are weighted performance categories. The weights are actually determined initially by statute, although there is a provision for some of them to shift over time depending on performance. Each of those weighted performance categories will have a 0 to 100 point score, which will be rolled up into a MIPS composite performance score, and then that MIPS composite performance score will be compared against different benchmarks that are determined by average performance overall. If we go to the next slide, you'll see that the year one performance category weights for MIPS are spelled out here as they would, as they have been in MACRA. So of course we propose those same splits. Quality weighs the heaviest in that first year at 50%. Resource use is the smallest at 10%. Advancing care information or some of the carryover of items for meaningful use weigh in at about a quarter. And then clinical practice improvement activities, the new category is weighted at 15%. That is determined by statute. And that is obviously what we're carrying forward into year one. If we go to the next slide, so what actually determines your MIPS score? It's going to be the score within each of these categories that gets added up into that total composite score. Now, within each of those categories, there are one of the things that we took as a mandate was to really provide multiple paths of success and achievement for folks. So there's a great deal of choice for different people in what quality measures you report, what clinical practice improvement activities you take part in, even the degree of investment of your practice in the different advance in care information EHR objectives is very wide open for a number of folks. Next slide. Under the quality performance category, we did propose a number of measures. Many of these measures people will recognize from PQRS. We do anticipate that that measure set will evolve over time. The category will be assessed based on your reporting on six quality measures. One of those measures will need to be a cross-cutting measure. And one of them will need to be an outcome measure. If an outcome measure isn't available, we would have one. You could select one that is a high priority measure. Those are identified within the regulation. You can select from individual measures. There are also some specialty measure sets. We did propose specific specialty measure sets for different specialties to be able to participate. We do think that over time, as more measures are available, that that number of specialty measure sets will grow. Population measures, there are some provisions for that within that quality category. They are automatically calculated on our end. I think some of the key changes you'll see here from what we originally had in PQRS is we have a reduced number of measures. We no longer have a specific domain requirement. We are really trying to emphasize, and I think over time you will see that we will emphasize outcome measurement as a whole. Next slide. So the resource use category is going to compare resources that you use to treat similar care episodes, clinical condition groups across different practices. It's important to remember that a lot of these measures can be risk adjusted to reflect external factors that are out of a clinician's control. Some of you are going to be familiar with some of this from what we did under the value-based modifier program. We're obviously going to do an assessment under all of the available resource use measures that are applicable to a clinician. We did propose what those are. It's a similar set to what we have under VBM currently, but we do think that we're going to expand that over time, obviously, and get to things that really group episodes of care. There are no reporting requirements here for clinicians. This is all claims-based measurement. We are adding about 40 or more episode-specific measures into this. That's different than what we currently have to address some of the specialty concerns. I think that a lot of the larger resource use measures that were in existence, we had heard loud and clear that people were under specialists were not able to participate to the fullest extent. So under the clinical practice improvement category, next slide, you'll see a number of areas for practice investments in care coordination or safety checklists. It's really meant to be a stepping stone and an open category as people transition into alternate payment models. Can you forward the slide, please? So we've provided some examples, and we have also made some suggestions about how we will solicit new examples for clinical practice improvement activities in the future. If we go to the next slide, you'll see how we are looking to score this. We're sort of rather than a percentage score here, we are looking for an achievement score. So in order not to receive a zero score in this category, you would have to do a minimum selection of one of the CPI activities. You see we proposed about 90 of them. There is additional credit for the more activities that you do. You will get full credit under this category if you are a patient or participating in a patient-centered medical home. There is a half credit if you are participating in an APM. You'll see, as I say over time, that I think we'll expand this category to really do some leading edge things and to think about that transition to an alternate payment model. I'm closing in on time, so I'm going to go through the rest of this very quickly, but I do want to cover meaningful use or advancing care information. If we go to the next slide, the thing that I want to say here is that it starts at 25%, but as more people become meaningful users, the percentage of this category will drop. We'll go to the next slide. This differs in a lot of ways from what we proposed for meaningful use in stage three. It carries some of the same objectives, but the way that we look at it and the way that we intend to score it or propose to score it will be very different. You can participate as a group. Previously under meaningful use, people could only participate as individuals. So that is a significant change. People who are facility-based physicians would not be subject under this category. We're proposing to reweight that category. And then there is an optional ability for other EPs who were not previously eligible for the EHR incentive programs or meaningful use to begin participating in this category. So, for example, Medicare NPs and PAs, clinical nurse specialists, and so on. Next page. Under this category, under this advancing care information category, we're proposing a composite score that would consist of a base score that you would get for reporting information in the category, a performance score that would look at the information you reported and break that into basically, we propose a decile basic system that would allow you to be scored. So basically, the better you perform on a particular measure, the higher your score in there will be. And then there's a bonus point that is actually available in this category related to public health reporting. All of those things add up to a composite score. If you earn 100 or more points in that composite score, you'll receive the full 25 points in that advancing care information category. Next slide. You'll see, like I said, that base score is participation as a meaningful user. So having a certified EHR and reporting on the required objectives that we propose and outline. If you go to the next slide, you'll see that the six objectives that we are proposing here are protecting patient health information. This is not a new one for people. We've been doing it since stage one. E-prescribing, patient electronic access to their electronic records, coordination of care through patient engagement, health information exchange. This is the transitions of care objective that many people are familiar with, and then public health and clinical data registry reporting. I won't go through each of those, but these should be fairly familiar objectives to people. If you go to the next page, I think actually we covered this under performance score. We would look at these different objectives and score higher based on your performance overall. So next page, I think the thing that I want to highlight here is that, you know, we really went with an idea of flexible scoring. We did drop what I think some people have thought of as the all or nothing threshold for measurement. So it's no longer a 30% or a 50% or an 80%. We really tried to remove either redundant measures or measures that were pretty highly reported, pretty highly topped out. We are proposing to eliminate the clinical provider order entry and clinical decision support objectives. We did reduce the number of public health reporting objectives that were required overall. Again, trying to get to a lean footprint here that really focuses on using an EHR for some of the most advanced care functions that will really be able to move things forward. So I'm at the top of the hour. I did not, unfortunately, get to take much of a look at the data submission or the performance period and payment adjustment information. That is there in the slide deck. I would encourage people to take a look. I would also encourage you to please take a look at the CMS website and take advantage of some of the other presentations that we'll be doing. We'll have some in-depth presentations on MIPS. We'll have some in-depth presentations on alternate payment models and the proposals related to them.
Rob, do you have a few minutes for questions or no?
I have perhaps a couple. Sorry, I'm got to run immediately after this.
Sure. So I'll just go by the first one that was asked, and this is a quick one. Does CMS do the analysis and scoring, or is this outsourced? And if the latter, to whom?
So it depends on what those categories are. I think traditionally for some programs, we have certainly outsourced that. We are in the middle of doing systems reviews internally to take a look at what can actually be done in-house with our systems. So the answer is it depends, and it hasn't really been determined yet.
Providers currently reporting via QCDR for colonoscopies would report via MIPS for 2017. I just realized maybe I've cut off part of the question, so I'll move on just because of time. What changes, if any, can we anticipate in the underlying risk adjustment methodologies under ICD-10 and HCC groupings based on MIPS and MACRA?
I'm not sure what the question relates to under ICD-10 groupings. I think They're trying to get at some of the episodes of care models that are required as part of Macro 102. And that is that's some information that we actually currently have posted on another website as part of a different process. We will continue to develop some of that and propose some models related to sort of these grouped episode codes. But that's not part of this current regulation.
Okay. I'll give you one more question because I know you have to leave. What certifications must medical homes achieve to be eligible for clinical practice improvement credit?
That is a question for the medical practice home folks. My understanding from what we've got in the reg, it's pretty broadly proposed. But if you are a participant within a medical practice home model, then you will receive that credit under the CPIA category.
So time for one more. Do you need to go? Tell me
if you can do a very quick one.
Okay, so will providers that are mental health providers and doing group reporting, since the majority of staff are not eligible providers for the advancing care category? This is really long. hang on a second. You mentioned that ACI's percentage will decrease in the future. Do you know when that might happen?
So it is dependent. It is a provision within the MACRA legislation that requires a certain percentage of people being meaningful users of an EHR before you can decrease that overall percentage. I believe that percentage is 75% of people who are eligible. So it very much will depend on participation within this category of the program. And with that, I think I have to say goodbye.
Well, we thank you so much for taking the time. I know your schedule has been very busy. Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody.
Mark?
Yeah, thanks, Claudia. And Rob did a great job. And, again, I'd certainly encourage people to take a close look at his slides, as well as the other material that CMS has on their website for this new program. It's now my pleasure to turn things over to Dr. Sam Ho, Chief Medical Officer and Executive Vice President of United Healthcare. As I mentioned, immediate past chair of EHI, Sam is going to introduce Dr. Lewis Sandy from United Health Group.
Thanks, Mark. I just want to turn this over in the interest of time to Dr. Lewis Sandy, who is our United Health Group executive, our clinical executive in charge of advancement and policy. And he's going to run through kind of our private sector approach to MACRA and maybe a little bit more on the APM side of this.
Yeah, thanks, Sam, and thanks, Mark, as well. Pleased to be here with you. I think what I'm going to sort of pull back and kind of provide the context for how MACRA fits into the changing landscape with a context since Rob had gone through some of the details of the MIPS side of MACRA as well. A couple other initial, you know, he did sort of the play-by-play. I'm going to do more color commentary. And the other thing I should point out right at the outset is MACRA is a program relating, as he mentioned, to Medicare fee-for-service. I'm not from CMS, so I am trying to wade through all those pages that Mark went through, and so if you have questions about MACRA, I will try and answer, but I probably won't have the answer, and even what I say may not be correct. So I just want to put those caveats out there. Why don't we go ahead to the next slide? And this is really the overview, and I think I just want to kind of put all of this in context because, EHI is kind of a diverse coalition, many of different kinds of stakeholders, and I think it's really more why is MACRA here now and what is it aiming at and how does it fit with other things that are going on, particularly in the private sector. That's what I wanted to cover in the front part of this. And I think my main points are really right here, that the reason that we're really engaged in a large-scale transformation from moving from traditional fee-for-service towards these alternative payment models and constructs such as MACRA is because everyone recognizes that we need more value out of healthcare spending. That all the analyses suggest that up to 30% of all health spending in the U.S. is wasted, doesn't benefit the patient. We have persistent, pervasive, unexplained variation in whatever you measure, whether it's quality, cost, or patient experience. And that one of the contributors to this, there's a lot of advantages in fee-for-service, but fee-for-service tends to reward volume and intensity, not value. So predating the ACA, but really accelerated by it, there has been the journey that many of us have been on for a number of years towards alternative payment models and delivery reforms in both the public and private sector. And MACRA is, I guess I think of MACRA as essentially reformation of Part B legacy Medicare fee-for-service payment in this same context. So I'm going to focus my comments of MACRA on the things that weren't mentioned, particularly around the APM side of it. And then if there's time, we can have some discussion in Q&A. Next slide. So again, let's level set. The reason this journey towards value is going so big and so fast is because about 30% of all healthcare spending is wasted. And the Institute of Medicine, now the National Academy of Medicine, did analyses bucketing out where this waste is in the U.S. healthcare system. And all the estimates done by many different organizations tend to converge around this 30% number, and I won't go through it, but it just shows how much opportunity there is to drive improvement in value. Next slide. And what does it mean to have higher value in healthcare? And I think a very important and useful organizing construct for that is the idea of the triple aim or the three-part aim developed by Tom Dolan and Don Berwick, to really address simultaneously controlling inflation of per capita costs, improving the health of populations, and improving the individual healthcare experience. So better health, better outcomes, better experience, better costs, and to do this simultaneously. That is really what the true north direction of higher value really means. Next slide. I'm going to speak for a moment around where we are, and we here is United Healthcare. As you, most of you know, United Health Group encompasses both United Healthcare, which operates benefits in all the different diverse business segments, individual, commercial, Medicare, Medicaid, military and veterans, retirees, and international as well. This is a depiction of where United Healthcare's journey towards payment reform has been and continues to accelerate. I'll show that in a moment. And this slide shows that we believe that it's important to develop a wide range of models for alternative payment because there is no one-size-fits-all. There has to be tailoring to local market circumstances and local dynamics, and the level, and these axes indicate this, the level of care provider integration, sophistication, and accountability to manage, for example, population-based payment here on the upper right-hand side, as well as increased financial risk. And down at the lower left is traditional fee-for-service, and then you can build off of fee-for-service some pretty basic incentive programs and performance-based contracts. And in the middle, you can have innovations such as bundled payments or episode-based payment focused on conditions or service lines. So this is how we at United Healthcare tend to think about payment reforms and bucketing out where we have spending in each of these. At the present time, the largest percentage in terms of dollars is focused in the lower half of this graph, but the fastest growing part of our journey towards value-based payment is in the upper right, managing entire population health. Next slide. And this shows our journey. Again, this predates health reform going back to 2011, where you had about $13 billion focused on tied to value-based contracts in UnitedHealthcare. At the end of 2015, we were over $45 billion, very rapid growth, and are on track to achieving over $65 billion in value-based contracting growth by 2018. And we've seen a range. These programs, and I won't present this today, almost uniformly show improvements in quality measures and outcomes, and they show a range of cost reduction across these programs from about 1 to 6%. So it just goes to show that driving towards value-based payment can both improve quality and reduce cost along the lines of the AAA. Next slide. This was already shown. This is HHS's version of how they had previously set pre-MACRA these goals to move towards alternative payment models, and then MACRA came along after these goals were established. So that's an important contextual piece that I don't think Rob highlighted. Next slide. And the other thing that HHS and CMS did pre-MACRA was develop something called the Healthcare Learning and Action Network, sometimes shorthanding called the LAN, which is a public-private collaboration designed to drive acceleration and alignment around alternative payment models. And one of the first things that the LAN did was to develop a framework so that we collectively, both the public sector, such as Medicare, and the private sector, such as payers like UnitedHealthcare, could have a common lexicon and a framework for determining and classifying different alternative payment models. And this is one, I won't go into it in detail. All the LAN materials, by the way, are publicly available. But this was the first effort. We had representation. UnitedHealthcare had a member of the work group that developed this from all the way legacy category 1, fee-for-service without a link to quality and value, to category 4, population-based payments, whether they're condition-based or comprehensive, such as global payment. So this was one piece that this framework is becoming increasingly used as an organizing construct to talk about alternative payment models. Next slide. And just like the UnitedHealthcare slide showed the growth and the maturation of different payment models, this is a schematic from the LAN showing what the future state is envisioned, with the current state heavily anchored in legacy fee-for-service with a spectrum of alternative payment models across these categories. Over time, at migration, there will still be payment in all these different approaches, but a larger and larger proportion in advanced alternative payment models, whether they are built off of a chassis of fee-for-service or whether they involve more prospective global payments, capitation, or variants of population-based payments. So this was important contextual information for MACRA, showing kind of where the whole field is going as we move toward this journey towards value. Next slide. So that gets to MACRA, and I think I'm going to skip ahead because these are also from CMS. Extracts, and because Rob covered a lot of this, but I do want to pause at one. Stop here for a second. This one I did want to pause on because Rob talked about MIPS and the different scoring categories to be scored in MIPS: quality, advancing care information, improvement, and resource use. Two things I'll highlight in my color commentary here, particularly for EHI. I guess I interpret MACRA as essentially the sunsetting of the construct of meaningful use towards a different construct that, as this slide indicates, has much greater emphasis on interoperability and information exchange. And I think that's really quite a positive. The other thing I would highlight here is that he went through this, and there are all these different options and different ways you can do it. There's much more flexibility here. There's flexibility and choice, but there's also a lot of complexity. And one of the things I'm struck with is how it's almost a sort of bewildering amount of choice available for the average physician or nurse practitioner to sort of figure out how this works. And as he mentioned, almost everyone will be in NIPS in the initial reporting period in 2017. So it's going to be a major challenge for all of us to just explain what this is and how it works. And from the private sector, although not we are not directly affected by this payment reformation of Medicare fee-for-service, Medicare is such a large payer, obviously, that what they do will tend to have reverberate through all of us and all the things that we're doing. So it's important for all of us to be knowledgeable as this unfolds over the next few years. Let's keep going. We showed that. That's the adjustments under MIPS. But let me stop here because Rob didn't talk about the other side of MACRA, which is the alternative payment models, which in a nutshell, the MIPS is sort of an adjustment to your fee schedule based on the MIPS scoring that we just went through. If you meet the qualification for this other track, this APM track, you get actually two kinds of increased compensation. You get an automatic bump in your Medicare fee schedule, and if you're performing in whatever alternative payment model you're in, you're going to get whatever financial incentives are in that particular APM. The other thing is, as he mentioned, there's also a fair amount of complexity. Let's go to the next slide. Oh, no, keep staying on this slide for 1 second. Go back to that. What is an alternative payment model under MACRA? It's not, I think it's important to point out, it's not exactly the same alternative payment model that we in the private sector talk about, or even this public-private collaboration, the Learning Action Network, talk about. There are special rules for what is an alternative payment model under MACRA, and these are part of it. One is models that have been APMs that are launched by the Innovation Center, and the Medicare Shared Savings Program, and other demonstrations. Now we can go to the next slide. And to not what you get if you actually meet the qualification for participation in APMs, you're not in MIPS, you receive a 5% lump sum bonus payment for 2019 to 2024, and you get higher fee schedule updates in that period as well. Next slide. This is a timeline that just shows where this is going to roll out. This is, again, a slide from CMS. The reporting period, as Rob mentioned, for MIPS, where most doctors and other health professionals subject to Part B will be in, starts in 2017. You start getting your rewards either under MIPS or APMs in 2019. And that over time, I think there, even though this 9% number is often bandied around, the other piece of color commentary, it could very well be that most Part B participants that are in MIPS are not going to get anywhere near 9% on the upside. The good side is not going to get anywhere near 9% on the downside. It's much more likely that most health professionals are getting pretty minuscule adjustments up or down, essentially keeping their Medicare fee schedule flat. So over time, even though MIPS will be the common thing in the beginning, if you really want to get paid more by Medicare, you're going to have to be in a qualified APM. And as Rob said, that also means not only do you have to be in an advanced APM as defined under MACRA, you actually have to have enough volume in that advanced APM to meet the MACRA requirements, to meet the statutory provisions. And as part of that volume requirement, even though this is a Medicare program, beginning in a few years, eligible professionals will get credit for being in other APMs that relate to the private sector. So UnitedHealthcare's payment models may also allow eligible professionals to meet the requirements under MACRA as well. So I think that's my last slide. So let me just summarize. Again, the context here is that we're in a rapidly changing environment towards transformation on towards value, both in how public and private purchasers pay, and the rules under which this operates. MACRA is an important program, a lot of flexibility, but a lot of complexity, and I think there will be ongoing efforts to try and accelerate these changes, try and align them when they make sense, but there will also be differences between the public and private sectors because it's different markets and different programs. So with that, I think we may have a couple minutes left for any questions or comments. I'm happy to take them. But remember, I'm not from CMS.
Claudia, do you have any questions?
Yes, there were several questions, and I thought I would go back. There were people that were asking questions for Rob, but perhaps Dr. Sandy can answer them as well, just so that we cover everyone. Let's see. One is, and I'm not sure about this, why are facility-based physicians separated out? What distinguishes them from any other provider than being more expensive to Medicare?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
Yeah.
One comment was, okay, do we know how the regulation works for super specialists or doctors who do not have direct patient contact?
Well, it applies, I know some of the answer to that. It does apply to everyone who is a Part B biller. So that's number one. So, and that there, the other thing, Rob mentioned this in passing, and I actually do think on the quality measure part of MIPS, this is one of the more interesting parts of the regulation. There are choices of what measures any specialist can report, including the development of specialty measure categories, so that an individual specialty, or to give a subspecialty, I think that's what is meant by the question, has the flexibility to suggest to CMS a measure set befitting that particular subspecialty. So that there are rules, draft rules in the NPRM for that. So that is going to be an interesting thing I think is an advance, because the legacy PQRS was often criticized for saying, look, you know, this is a kind of one-size-fits-all. You know, none of these quality measures apply to my specialty. So I think there is some flexibility there.
And Lou, this is Mark. Just to add to that, on some of the specialties, radiologists, anesthesiologists, and pathologists that had previously been eligible for hardship exemptions under meaningful use, what CMS proposes is that for those specialties where they're either defined as not being patient-facing or not really having the same kind of responsibilities for long-term follow-up with patients, that basically the advancing care information category, the one formerly known as meaningful use, would essentially be weighted zero, and then those points are sort of redistributed to the other categories. In addition, for some of the highly specialized specialties where conceivably there might not be quality measures available or there might be challenges in some of the other categories, CMS has the capability similarly to zero out a non-applicable category and then to basically redistribute the points to categories that are applicable for that specialty. So they're certainly prepared to act on that. Some of it is known, as I said, for radiologists, anesthesiologists, and pathologists. Others, it's sort of something in their hip pocket as needed.
Another question is, where do you see the process of prior authorization in MIPS and APMs?
Well, prior authorization is a kind of a process that is used by payers for pre- or post-service review about medical necessity or determinations. Legacy Medicare fee-for-service doesn't have processes like that. It'll be, however, it is, and nor formally do, you know, alternative payment models in the same way that a payer might. However, an alternative payment model, if paid a global budget, for example, obviously has incentives for managing to the triple aim for their defined population, and may have their own internal processes. Those kinds of processes are really internal to the APM itself, and kind of are within the scope of the rules of that APM. To give a current example, for example, in the Medicare Shared Savings ACO programs, you know, there's no provision that prevents the Medicare beneficiary from going anywhere they want, rather than a closed network, which you often may see in the commercial marketplace. So it's a little bit out of scope for MACRA, but there are sort of analogous processes in some of the alternative payment models.
Another question is, how will the transition from meaningful use to MACRA MIPS work for EPs who participated fully in meaningful use? And then, do the EPs get any special consideration?
Well, I guess I'll answer partly, but many of you are as knowledgeable, if not more so, than I am. Certainly, one of the foundational requirements is to qualify is to use certified EHR technology. So anybody who's been participating in meaningful use, you know, has got that covered. And I guess, again, this is probably color commentary, anyone who has been fully participating in meaningful use ought to have a leg up in meeting this component of MIPS, because it's sort of functionality that is already included in the in the legacy meaningful use programs, which it should be easier to meet those requirements rather than starting from scratch. It would be my thought.
So in the interest of time, because I know that the hour is up and people probably are thinking about going home, but I wanted to just do one more question, if you don't mind, and that's, how do ACOs fit into the APM model?
Well, they do, in the sense that they do meet the requirements for the advanced APM, but not all of them. I believe it's track two and I have to go back and look at that.
Track two and track three.
Yeah, track two and track three. That's what I was just saying. Those meet the requirements in the proposed rule for a qualified APM, but then remember that in order to actually get paid more, you not only have to be participating, but you have to be participating in a sufficient volume to meet threshold requirements, which is why CMS has said almost everyone will be in MIPS in the first year.
Fantastic. Thank you. So I know that Mark has a few comments, summarizing comments. So, Mark?
Yeah, thanks. And again, thank you very much, Lou and Sam, and to Rob, who had to drop. I think a point that Rob made at the outset is really critical. This is a proposed rule, and that has two key implications. One is that it's not cast in stone, and that there are opportunities to change things. And then secondly, we all related to that in a sense. Many of us who are involved with this as providers, vendors, others, need to, in a sense, be making bets about the outcome, because the time is really very short, with the first reporting year under this program being 2017. I'd also like to emphasize, and I think both Rob and Lou touched on it, the importance of the patient-centered medical home in potentially being able to qualify one as either an advanced APM or getting some additional credit under MIPS. Also, you know, despite some really important simplification where CMS was listening to people, as Lou emphasized, there's a fair amount of complexity. You know, again, just the length of the rule and figuring it all out, and I think we could see some of that in Rob's slides. You know, also, and again, this is something I've been living with for a number of years now, I think meaningful use, although it's been renamed and rebranded, and some of the concepts have changed, the notion about meaningful use of certified EHR technology and being evaluated on that really is still with us. very notable that CMS did away with the all or nothing approach to meaningful use. But on the other hand, as you dig into this, you'll see that, in fact, to score at the highest level for that category, in many cases, there's going to be pressure to excel and to actually achieve levels above what would have been in place for stage three. A couple of other final points. One is, as we think about this and think about the broad set of components of the new program, that audits and auditors will still be with us, and that those audits could cover a broader set of activities, including these clinical practice improvement activities. And so it will be important to make sure that folks have the appropriate record-keeping systems in place. HHS is also clearly the federal government moving deeper into care delivery, both with the APM model and as you look at some of the components of these clinical practice improvement activities. And so I'll just sort of stop there. I think the more you read this and talk to colleagues, the more insights there are to be gleaned. So I would encourage people to participate in calls like this, listening sessions that CMS is having, and other kinds of industry opportunities to dig into and to think about what kinds of actions are appropriate to take now or in the future based on this proposed rule. So with that, Claudia, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, I just really want to thank our really amazing speakers for taking the time and to do this and sharing their expertise on this very interesting subject. So for all of you who participated on the call, we really appreciate your attendance. And on that note, we'll close the webinar and look forward to further sessions. Thank you very much.